Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And in this episode, we are going to be talking about the topic of nightlife and the nighttime economy and doing that with somebody who is doing amazing, interesting, awesome things in a city that you would not associate with being a vibrant nightlife city. Anyway, this is Mathieu Grandin, and he's a Montrealer who did a lot of advocacy around the things that were sort of bogging down or inhibiting the nighttime economy, especially around entertainment and culture in Montreal, which is probably the best city for that in Canada, albeit it has lots and lots of challenges, as I've learned from living here. Anyway, Mathieu did a lot of this from the advocacy side. And then I came across him when he became the nightlife commissioner for the city of Ottawa, which is not a city that most people would think of when it comes to late night entertainment or even culture. It's a government town. But this conversation might change your perspective on that, because he's actually doing a lot of amazing things, and the city of Ottawa has a lot of energy and enthusiasm to go, right, how do we become more than a government town so that people want to play here, people will spend money here, and it will come with all the benefits that go along with that. So this is one of those proper Challenger City conversations, and I think it's a good one where Ottawa is showing up a few other places for what it means to become a Challenger City for the nighttime economy, nightlife, entertainment and culture. Anyway, enough from me. We're going to get right into this with a conversation with Mathieu Grandin. But Mathieu, thank you so much for having a chat with me, because I think you have one of the most interesting jobs in Canada right now, and doing it in a city that no one ever gives any credit to, in Ottawa. So I want to have a chat with you about nightlife, and given you're Ottawa's nightlife commissioner, and I think the first guy in Canada who has a role with that title, you're the perfect person to talk to. But to get into it, I'd love to like get you to sort of tell us a little bit about yourself and your backstory and how you ended up doing what you're doing in Ottawa now.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Ian. It is probably the... Well, for me, it's the most interesting job I ever got. And it's a job that I've pushed cities to create. So when I saw that Ottawa was hopping on the quote unquote nightmare, I don't like the word, but nightmare movement, we can talk about that later maybe. But I thought it was a fantastic opportunity. So I applied and I was ready to leave friends, family and lovers behind in Montreal and move to Ottawa to kick off this movement. And it's, now it's starting to snowball. Vancouver announced a couple of weeks ago that they were going to create a similar position. So, well, about me, you know, I started, I was always in the arts and culture sector. I started off as a child actor, actually, when I was cool. 5 years old. And I acted until I was 25. Then I switched to directing. I was fed up with public life. And now I'm back at public life, but that's the irony of life and career paths. So yeah, and I worked in behind the camera for almost another 20 years. I started off as directing a lot of music videos, because that's music's always been a passion for me. Yeah. My father was a radio host when I was younger, so you know we would work the night shifts actually on the radio. So sometimes I'd be very lucky, and he'd bring me with him. I would fall asleep on the couch in the studio around midnight, and he would end his shift around 3. So that was, I felt very privileged to be up when all the kids had to be in bed. So that maybe was what kicked off my obsession with nightlife. And then in my teenage years, trying to rebel again. Cool parents who were really into yacht rock and soft rock, and I discovered techno music and raves, and I thought, yeah, they're never gonna get that. So first rave party was 96. I was 15 years old, and 97 I was 16. I bought 2 turntables and a mixer, and I started DJing, and I've been doing it since, more as a hobby than anything else. And then fast forward 2012, actually, we started seeing a pushback against bars and live music venues in Montreal regarding noise complaints and politicians really empowering NIMBYism, where, you know, I remember the borough mayor of the Plateau Mont-Royal saying, like, if you live above a bar, you're entitled to the same level of quietness as anybody else. So that's when I started my activism to defend nightlife institutions, venues. And then in 2017, I got together with a few friends, promoters, and we created the Montréal 24/24, so 24-hour Montreal, an organization that you know, wanted to defend the rights of people who live at night and support the development of nightlife and destigmatize nightlife activities. This opened up a discussion with the city of Montreal, where some politicians were in favor and some were like privately in favor, publicly against, because, you know, they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place sometimes with their constituents, where some of their constituents are really advocating against nightlife. So, this opened up a discussion. We created an action plan, then COVID hit, everything got shut down. I think the three levels of governments felt really bad for shutting us down. And we crafted an action plan to relaunch nightlife after COVID. And this got financial support from the city and from the provincial government. So with that, we created a nightlife council. We published two studies, one on the economic impact of nightlife, the other creative footprint from Vibe Lab. That's an international study that could compare the creative footprint of our venues against those in Berlin and Tokyo. So that was super instructive. And then we created the Nightlife Summit, and we also had pilot projects, one of them being testing the extension of licensing hours in Montreal. So the first one we ran a venue, we ran that venue for 29 hours nonstop with bar service throughout, like you would find in Berlin, to amass data and see what the impact would be on safety, on public space, on the economic, you know, financial revenues of venues for artists, et cetera. And this has been very positive because now the city of Montreal is supposed to roll out these 24-hour licenses. I think there's 19 venues that will be announced soon this spring, this summer. Montreal will be the first city in Canada to have those types of licenses. So, yeah. And meanwhile, that plan eventually ended up with the city, and they decided against funding us again for our next action plan. So I was out of work, and Ottawa had been listening very closely to the work we'd been doing in Montreal and decided to follow my advice back then, which was for Montreal to create a nightlife commissioner position and a nightlife office to manage and develop nightlife. Well, Ottawa did it. So, too bad, Montreal. Bye-bye. I jumped in my car, took the 417 or actually the 50 and ended up in Ottawa.
So it's like you designed your ideal job, but you designed it. You end up getting it in the wrong city.
Yeah, kind of. Even the word commissioner was actually like, because at some point in Montreal, we were like, I was speaking with someone who was working for the city and supporting us with the plan. And she was like, well, you know, I'm not high up enough in the hierarchy to change things. You know, when I want to talk to zoning, they don't care because I'm too low in the hierarchy. So I looked at the governance structure of the city of Montreal, and so we had like a commissioner for French language and a commissioner for racism, and I was like, well, maybe we should have a commissioner for nightlife. So even the title, I kind of made it up. So yeah,
nice. Well, at least it exists. And I think, like, I can maybe be a little bit mean about Ottawa, but like, Ottawa is not a city that you think of for nightlife. So I feel like you've got like such a low bar, but maybe that gives you a much more interesting slate.
It's, you know, I can't say that Ottawa was on my radar in terms of nightlife, because Ottawa lives in the shadow of its two bigger siblings, Toronto. It's like your older brother that has made a lot of money and is very successful. And then Montreal, which is like your sister with a fine art degree that has sometimes issue and doesn't show up at Christmas, but is also cool. Ottawa is like, it's caught up in the shadows of these two siblings. So, but... The positive thing compared to Montreal and Toronto, like bigger cities, have issues with nightlife that they need to manage. Mm-hmm. And as I said, sometimes the politicians are stuck between a rock and a hard place. And so it's tough to get these things moving. This file, the nightlife file, becomes politicized really fast. Whereas in mid-sized cities like Ottawa, everything is about development. So everyone is super optimistic, super, super supportive. I've had support from all municipal councillors, all different departments within city administration, and obviously the external partners too, the associations, organizations like the Ottawa music industry, the tourism destination development organizations, and everyone wants to get rid of that reputation.
Yeah.
No, of a sleepy government town. And I gotta say, I wasn't aware of that reputation of Ottawa. Well, I was aware that, you know, it was not on my radar as a nightlife place, but I did not understand the depth of this scar and wounds that this reputation has given you know, has done to the city. And then from discussing with other Canadian cities, because moving here to Ottawa opened the doors of the rest of Canada to me, because Montreal, you know, because of French language, sometimes you're a bit stuck with in Quebec. Well, Vancouver's nickname is No Fun City. And then Toronto, they call it Toronto the Good, as opposed to Toronto the Fun. So there seems to be like an ongoing trend there that Canada has a branding problem, an image problem when it comes to nightlife. And when I travel around the world and I say I'm a nightlife advocate from Canada, I've had some chuckles from, you know, Germans who were like, oh, Canada, don't you have just forest and polar bears there? So that's my bad German accent.
That's quite good, actually. I enjoyed that.
So, that's something I think we need to develop and grow and start putting some real thought into this.
It's interesting though, because I, like, for me, having moved to Montreal 6 or 7 months ago, Montreal's not a super late night city. It's got pockets of it, but it's not what I thought. I thought it was going to be more Berlin-like, and it's not.
It is the closest you can get.
It is. It's the closest you can get. But like, I was at a gig the other week, and like the band, I've never turned up to a gig where I've like got their 3 songs into the headline act, and they were off the stage by 9:35. I was like,
yeah, especially since COVID. You know, it's kind of like the worst time right now in my life, at least, to start developing and considering nightlife, because, you know, the nightlife sector globally has been facing challenge and crisis after crisis. COVID hit, then we had a surge when we came back, lasted 6 months, and everything crashed down again. Mm-hmm. There's affordability issues, inflation, now tariffs, changing consumer trends, the younger generation that don't drink, that, you know, don't socialize the same way, if they socialize at all sometimes. So it's a tough time, and it's at the same time, it's probably the most relevant time right now to start acting upon this, because we got to act on this. We got to act on this situation.
Yeah. I think there's something really interesting of, it's not just about people going out, listening to music, having drinks. There's like that thing of, I don't think people necessarily realize, like, the nighttime economy is, there's lots of people who work at night. They might be like nurses, or might be engineers that are like doing construction in the nighttime hours. And then if you have a healthy nighttime economy for entertainment and culture, those two worlds actually come together in a way that's really healthy. I remember being in Berlin at a Currywurst stand, and I've been at a club until 6 a.m. and I'm like eating Currywurst, and there's people who've just come off the shift of doing repairs on a train station. But like, those two worlds match up. And if you do that, then you have a healthier, happier city.
No, I mean, you know, I've had friends who work in the healthcare system, and they work the night shift, and they're like, oh, finally, we'll be able to have our own happy hour, you know, at 6 a.m. We can go out and have a beer too, you know, because, you know, people who work nighttime shifts pay the same amount of taxes as everybody else, but they don't have the same access to the institution, infrastructure, and amenities that day people get. They can't go to the library, the public library, the public pool. You know, the retail stores are closed, you know. So, yeah, it's the plan here in Ottawa has been focused solely on nightlife for now. But talk about that nighttime economy, and then discuss, you know, what's the reality of a nurse that works the night shift and is a single mom, and they work the night shift at the hospital. In English, the word is daycare, you know. So it's something I think, you know, as cities, we want to be, we're talking about building inclusive cities. There must be space for everyone in the city, not just necessarily nuclear families of middle class that have a 9-to-5 work shift, but also people who might have atypical schedules and atypical lifestyles. And if we don't give them, these people, a space in the city, they're not going to fit anywhere else. Where do you want them to fit? So I think it's important to develop your economy, because even for people who work daytime, like 9-to-5, that's when they amass their wealth. But they need time to spend that wealth. If they finish at 5, they go home, they cook a meal, or they want to go, you know, they want to go out after, and everything shuts down at 9. I mean, that money is not going somewhere, you know. So
they leave the country when they go on an expensive vacation.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Because they want some nightlife.
But, well, yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it is part of the reason why Ottawa got into this action plan, because it's not good for the city that if some people, especially, for instance, in the electronic music scene in Ottawa, have been going to Stereo in Montreal every second weekend, you know, and it's like, so that money is being spent somewhere else. So if you can keep that wealth locally and have people spending in their own city for their own artists, to their own businesses, it's better for your local economy.
Yeah. And it's also like, I feel like for the Canadian government, you don't want your government workers to be drones that sort of go to the office 9 to 5 and don't have a chance to blow off some steam. Like if they actually have like more cultural activities happening around them, they'll probably be more, this might be a bit of a leap, but they'll be more creative in their jobs.
I mean, it's part of retaining your workforce. You know, like when the City of Ottawa surveyed, like the Economic Development Services of the City of Ottawa surveyed the tech sector, because we have a big tech sector in Ottawa, in 2017. And the biggest problem they had was the retention of their workforce and attracting those talents, because this is a highly well-paid, highly mobile workforce. It could work from in Toronto, Montreal, or London, Barcelona, Stockholm. And how do you convince them to move to Ottawa? Well, they're going to look at, do you have good restaurants there? What times do the bars close? Is my favorite band going to ever perform there? And that's, you know, I'm not even talking about having Taylor Swift, but, you know, these are real questions.
Yeah.
Developing your nightlife, you know, it develops the sexiness of your city. You know, it builds an attraction. It builds its attractivity. That's not a word in English, but you know what I get.
Yeah. But like there's the biggest major objections to nightlife. Like the NIMBYism comes from there's too much noise, there's antisocial behavior, often to do with drinking. Those feel like the two biggest things that people say, like, we have a problem with this. How do you counter some of that? Or am I missing something?
Well, I mean, when you have it, this is what you start to say. And when you don't have it, well, you see it differently. These issues are not huge issues here in Ottawa. People here are focused on, you know, can we get good public transit at night? Because we would like to be able to go out, but we can't. Can we get those bands to come to Ottawa? Can we, you know, can there's stuff I'm looking at that's available elsewhere and it's not available here. You know, there's too big of a, I mean, we need to diversify our economy because 26% of the workforce works for the federal government. So there's a dependency there that pushes a certain lifestyle too, you know? So that's what we're looking at. And elsewhere, like in Montreal, yes, there's, you know, the problem of noise or music, I would prefer to call it. And in civilities, it's been there, but it's not so much anymore. People don't drink as much as they used to drink in the 80s, and people would fight and they would be drunk. And you don't really see that anymore. But there's, you know, these issues must be managed, and they're actually easier to manage than, you know, funding public transit system appropriately. You know, having harm reduction, street teams, you know, bringing the whole wellness and caring attitude to nightlife is key to success. And when it comes to noise problems, well, you need to open up a discussion. You need mediation program. You need sound and fair, a regulatory framework. You need funding program for soundproofing. You need a good zoning. You need a proper licensing so that everyone knows what is their role and their responsibilities and what is the sandbox they can play in. Because right now you open, you know, in Montreal, you open a business, a venue or a bar, and you might, you know, invest $200,000 in it, and then you open it up on day one and you turn on the sound system, and then boom, no, we're not going to let you operate. So there's something that's wrong, that's broken in this system, and it takes an understanding of what this ecosystem is and how it works. And that's the problem we've had, is that politically we have politicians that don't really master the topic and are just trying to make political postures over it, you know, to look good, to look like, oh yes, we are defending the venues. Yes, culture is important. But at the end of the day, it's easier sometimes for politicians to throw money at a problem instead of attacking the root source of the problems if they can figure out what the problems are. That's why I've been pushing for cities to create these nightlife commissioner, nightlife, direct offices of nightlife, call it whatever you want, because you need someone from the sector, someone that understands, you know, the nightlife community and industry, that works within the administrative structure of a city. And I like to say that, you know, when I was in advocacy, it was a fun thing because only thing I could do is just point at all the problems, everything the city is doing wrong. Yeah. And the media love you because that's what you always got a good soundbite. Yeah, you always got a good soundbite. But at some point, it gets frustrating because you want to fix those problems and there's no one over there to fix them. There's only people saying, yeah, it's important, yeah, but they never fix anything. So I wanted to jump from, you know, advocacy to bureaucracy to kind of, and I see myself a bit like a mechanics. I'm getting my hands dirty trying to fix the engine, you know. I'm working under the car and I'm like, we gotta fix this and this and this and that. So that's what's gonna make your car, you know, car run properly. It's a job that's sometimes people have this idea because they call these positions nightmares and it's very glamour and that you can decide whenever you want, but actually you can't decide anything. The only thing you can do is try and advocate and convince people that these things need to be changed. So you're still advocating, but you're advocating inside city administration. So yeah, that gives you another type of leverage.
One of the things that you hosted this Canada After Dark conference, yep, summit. I thought it was great. But I didn't realize the extent of which that in certain cities, there's people who will build a condo near an established historic music venue, and then people will move into the condo and then complain about the noise.
Well, you're in Montreal. You should know. It's the city for that. It's been like this for a decade in Montreal.
I'm new here still. I had no idea that was like a thing. And it feels like, I think in my head, I had a version of Montreal that's like wasn't very Toronto, and I see sort of Toronto things with a Quebec accent still exist here. Thankfully, not too many, but some still do exist.
We have the language, but we don't really have the culture. We have the same culture in many aspects as the rest of Canada. You know, it's risk aversion, and a lot of it is about building new condos, new towers, building. Yeah. You know, we have little regard for heritage and stuff like that because this is North America. But yeah, I mean, you know, we've been advocating in Montreal for... Hey, when I started a Montreal 24/24 in 2017, I remember I spoke with someone from the cultural services about the agent of change principle. And you know what the agent of change principle is?
No, you got to explain that.
No? Okay. The agent of change principle is a principle that's usually in the official plan of a city. And it got adopted in London and in Australia, pioneered it 2015, 2014, I believe. And it's basically, it's a fluid and dynamic principle of zoning, but it's like if I move next to your venue or bar and you were there before and you haven't changed anything, well, it's up to me to adapt myself to my environment. And if I think I hear your bar or your venue, well, it's up to me to soundproof my windows, for instance. Yeah. But it's also, it's a fluid thing. So it's a two-way street. So if, you know, you open up a venue next to my dwelling, and then, you know, all of a sudden I can't sleep at night, well, it's going to be up to you to soundproof your venue appropriately. So this principle has been one of the tools. It's not a magic solution, but it's one of the tools to address noise nuisances and cohabitation problems. And I had this discussion with the cultural services in 2017, and they were like, yeah, it's been a few years already. We've been trying to push for this principle in the official plan of Montreal, and it hasn't moved. And now we're in 2024, and it still isn't there. You know, still isn't there. Thankfully, Ottawa did it. For the Byward Market District, hasn't been much activated yet. So, and I'd like to see this, adopted citywide at some point. But yeah, it is a thing. It is a thing. When there's a lot of density in a city, you got to manage these things. So, you know, the New York City Nightlife Office put out a mediation of neighborhood conflict program or something like this. So it's like it's a mediation thing. And this has proved really effective to manage these noise issues, because the problem is in the cities, even though there's a lot of people, people are lonelier than they've ever been. You know, they don't even know the name of their neighbor next door in their apartment building. Whereas in rural areas, you might think that you're very lonely, but because your next door neighbor is 2 kilometers away. But let me tell you, you know what their names are, you know, because you need them when you have a problem. So, Yeah, I think, you know, opening up this dialogue between nightlife operators and residents is essential to addressing this issue.
So in terms of, like, you landed in this role in Ottawa, you're now in the bureaucracy, but you're doing advocacy within the bureaucracy. What's been the, like, how do you find, like, navigating that? Because it must be quite different. How do you, what's the reaction? What's the reception? What the, like, the wins that you've had? Because you've not been doing it for that long. It's been, what, 18 months, 2 years?
A year. It's going to be a year tomorrow.
Okay. Happy anniversary. Like, in that year, what have you found? What surprised you? What stressed you out? Like, what's that year in that role been like?
Well, I mean, the first 6 months were spent just building those relationships with the external partners, but also our internal partners inside the administration, mm-hmm. from the housing services, the community services, cultural services, bylaw. Bylaw is a huge partner in this because, you know, bylaw and the bylaw services and the police historically have been, you know, running the night. They were the ones on the field at night. So all of a sudden you're like, yeah, but no, you're not going to do this like that anymore. And, you know, we want to have a discussion about that. So, you know, you have to be able to create those connections, as I said, and build that trust and sometimes desensitize them over some new changes because it's like, oh, we're going to do it like that. And we're not going to do it like this. We're going to do it like that. And it's like, oh, it's a big deal. And then you start doing it. And it's like, well, no, okay, actually, that didn't change much. If we extended licensing in Montreal was a big thing, you know, like it's the same, like full on opposition by the paramedics, by the police, by the firefighters. And then they did it. And then once after a few years, we did it 80 venues at the same time during Nuit Blanche. And the paramedics told me it was a slow night because we extended it. So people think, oh, yeah, it's going to be hell. But what happens is it's actually the opposite because you avoid
the curve.
Yeah, you know, you stagger closing times naturally. You avoid creating an artificial rush hour when all the clubs and bars shut down at the same time and everybody's fighting for the same taxi, the same slice of pizza. So, and you keep these adults under the supervision of the professional, you know. So it's kind of like a daycare for adults. That's how I like to picture bars and nightclubs, you know. So you need professionals there to take care of them. So, I mean, a lot of it is about, you know, having a good political acumen, a good sense of diplomacy, being able to, you know, dialogue, open up a dialogue and value the other person's or the other service's perspective on things too. Because, you know, paramedics, if you ask them, of course, you know, nighttime for them, it's like what they see is only the negative of night. They don't see the good parts of nightlife. They see people who have accidents because they drank too much and they drove their cars. That's their reality. So you got to be able to put yourself in their shoes for a minute. And, you know, it might be, it is a small amount of accidents that happen within all the other activities that happen in one night in a city, but that's the only thing they see. You know, you got to bring them to adopt your perspective and you got to be able also to adopt theirs.
I always think of like the stories. I think it used to be Sydney, but they used to have like one of the earliest last calls in the world. It was something like 9 o'clock. So you'd have people just like, how much can we drink between finishing work at 5 and starting and like finishing drinking at 9? And then there was a lot of resistance to pushing last call back. And then when they did, like the incidents fell off a cliff because nobody was racing to get 10 schooners down the neck.
Exactly. When we did the first pilot, the 29-hour party, the people running SAT had told us they had less incidents during those 29 hours than they usually do during a regular 3 a.m. closing time event, you know, because everyone wanted to be there later. Everyone was pacing each other, pacing their drinks a little bit more because they wanted to be there and last longer. And we had like two or three-ish, you know, people who had, you know, a little bit too much to drink or they took other substances. That's the worst we had for like 29 hours, except when we closed down on the second night, we shut down at 3 a.m. So we kicked out 1,200 people at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then we had more problems on the public street, on the street at that point. So the second year when we did it, we went like, no, we're going to go 30. We're going to kick him out around 6, 7 a.m. So by then, you know, they just do their walk of shame to the metro, to the taxi, and it's super smooth, you know, because when we kick them out at three, the hormones are high, everybody's drunk, they just had a couple shooters before it shuts down, and then 20 minutes later, they're arguing on the street because someone touched their cars or something, you know, so.
There's always an interesting thing of when you see the first metro in a system where the metro shuts down overnight, and you get on the first metro the following morning after a night out. I always remember being on like the metro in Seoul on November the 1st. And it was just like a sea, like everything you would see in Seoul is sort of organized, clean, polite, courteous. But like at 7 a.m. on a Sunday, on November the 1st, everyone like coming out from Halloween, it was a sea of carnage. But like, it was kind of almost like one of the best things to see.
Yeah, these were my favorite metro rides when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah. You talked earlier about like bringing artists to the city. So this was talked about a bit in the... I've never been... like, I don't know Ottawa very well. But everyone kept on referencing a venue called Barrymore's of like, it's no longer around, but like one bad gig can like... like venues are actually quite precarious things. There's a whole thing around actually bringing artists to a city, helping venues host them, helping them be marketed and sell out. I thought that was like a really interesting thing that probably doesn't go spoken about enough. People don't think about like the promoter or the venue side of the story.
But I think the story of Barrymore's is just, it's a testament to the impact, the community impact of music venues, you know, to their neighborhood. You know, we had two venues, Barrymore's and Babylon's, were right next to each other. Each of them would, you know, the capacity was maybe 500, 600, 700 people. So, you know, double that, it's like over 1,000 people, 3 nights a week, at least Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays that, you know, come there. So they're going to have, they might have a falafel before or after at some point. There's security out on the street. Mm-hmm. There's a lineup. There's people moving around. That part was very vibrant. And then they both shut down during COVID. And since they haven't reopened since then, and that part of the street right now is very devitalized. And it's a place where people don't feel safe to walk at night, especially considering that since the COVID pandemic, also we've had a lot of mental health issues, open drug use in the public space, homelessness issues. So, you know, how having a vibrant nightlife packs the vibrancy of your community and the sense of safety on the street at night is very important. So this is what, you know, I say, we talk about nighttime economies. Well, culture is the main main engine there for the economy. And within culture, music and the artists are the main engine of culture. You know, it's not the museum so much that bring vibrancy at midnight. It's the music, it's the nightclubs, it's the live music. So, you know, and it's also the closing of these two venues also brought a big gap in the venue ladder when you develop emerging talents. Talent, like, you know, you need, first of all, you need rehearsal space because that's where they're going to start. And then eventually they'll have their first show probably inside their rehearsal space with their friends. So you got to be able to be flexible and allow that. And sometimes we don't because it's not like, it's not a real venue, doesn't have the real certificate, blah, 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 blah. And then they're going to move on and graduate and perform it over, you know, in front of 100 people, 200 people. And eventually they'll play 2,000 people or 50,000 people. But right now, those two venues closing down, we have a gap in Ottawa for around 500 to 600 capacity venues. We don't have that. So, you know, we got to look at what can we do to bring back a venue of that capacity, of that size in the city, because it's important for the development of our own talents and also to bring in a certain types of bands that, you know, may not fill up 2,000 people in Ottawa, but will fill up a 500 capacity venue.
Yeah. It's also like the music discoverability. Everyone raved about sort of like Spotify being a better way for you to discover music. And in some ways, it's really good for you to discover something you would never go to or a band from another part of the world. But also the algorithm teaches you or is trained effectively on here's what you normally listen to. So you don't necessarily jump genre very easily. Mm-hmm. Whereas like often the best way of discovering new music is your mate says, do you want to come and see this band tonight? And then you might listen to a little bit of it. You listen, oh, I'm quite into that. And then you get more into it. But I feel like that's like the discoverability of new stuff gets a huge hit when you don't have the smaller venue.
Yeah, we're losing the middle class of culture in many ways because I think, especially with social media now and the younger generation, they like what they see is what they see under social media. So what they want are these big experiences, these premiums and stuff. And so, you know, it's the same with music and on Spotify. Either, you know, you're going to get a 20-cent check or you're going to get a $20 million check. But there's no more middle class there. And that's hurting the industry at large, you know. So I always say, like, now, like, for it's, you know, it's not as easy to make a living booking bands in a dingy basement with a bad sound system. That used to be, you know, the industry like 25 years ago. You know, that was, I would go out to see a show, pay $8, and it was just, you know, make a try and try it out, you'll see. But now it's not $8, it's $35. There's people, so people don't want that bad sound system anymore. Yeah. They want the good stuff. No, it's the same with beer. When I was a kid, I had $20 to go out. That was five Pabst. Five cheap beers, you know, quantity over quality. And now it's the opposite, you know. They'd rather have one glass of natural French white wine for $18,
yeah,
and they'll stop it there. So, you know, trends are changing, and I think the industry will have to adapt. But you're totally right in terms of the discoverability of artists, and especially when you have, like, for instance, people in a situation of a linguistic minority, for like, for instance, Quebecois artists. It's tough to get out of the bubble of Quebec.
Yeah, I have this problem as an Anglophone in Montreal. Of like, I have no idea who any of those people are. People are like, yeah, telling me they're huge in Quebec. I'm like, fine, I'll go discover it. It might be a way of me improving my French. But
yeah,
I have the good problem. They have the bad problem of getting out of it.
Yeah, it's Quebec is very much like Hungary and Romania. You know, it's a closed star system, and it's, if you don't speak the language, it's very tough to go in. It's gonna take a lot of efforts to be able to integrate it and start figuring out. Figuring it out. So, yeah.
I remember going to, like, people at Lotto Quebec gave me some tickets to go see Charlotte Cardin, like, years ago. And I was like, I've never heard of her. And they looked at me like I was some sort of alien. I'm like, I don't know who she is. I'm happy to have to go along with it. And it was amazing. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's also, like, 10,000 people here. Like, I'm like, this is on me, not on
the, but she's making it big now. She's got her big Spotify billboard in Toronto.
Yeah. Last time I was in the UK, I heard her playing. I was like, that's really cool. So how do you help solve some of those problems as, like, being the nightlife commissioner? It's really about creating the conditions for people to be successful. You can't be the problem solver for everything.
Well, I mean, it depends what the problem is, but I think the first mission of a nightlife commissioner is to create this public conversation, to bring up this topic. You know, like, nightlife, honestly, in Montreal, the word vie nocturne was not on the radar until we created Montréal 24/24 and started to push for it. And now it's like, oh, we have a policy on nightlife. Everybody talks about nightlife. And it's the same here in Ottawa. 2 years ago, the word nightlife was not in the media so much. And if we made I'd be curious just to make a study of how many times the word nightlife appears in news articles in the last 2 years. Like, it's been going up and up and up. So just creating this conversation brings this topic on people's mind. And then it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, how is my project impacting nightlife? You know, and by project, I mean, I could mean like a condo tower. So it's developing this reflex of what's going to happen after 6 p.m. You know, how can this, maybe if we made these little changes to our project, it would have a bigger impact at night, you know. So, yeah, creating this conversation is a big part of the role. And then liaising with the businesses and the different departments. Sometimes, you know, you fix a lot of small problems, like, oh, you know, I can't get my permit for this, and now they're asking for that, and then it's so you bring awareness to the condition of the sector. Like, listen, yes, I understand for safety you want this, but you are asking this 3 days before the event, and that's $5,000, and this group doesn't have $5,000 put this up, you know. So can we, like, you know, can we find some flexibility here? So that's the type of things you can do. And then there's looking at the framework conditions, like the big picture, the bylaw, the zoning, the licensing, the permitting, all of that, to try and make it, you know, adapted a little bit more to the reality of the nightlife operators. But of course, I mean, there's bigger structural problems here, you know, like public transit, for instance. This is not within my zone of control, within my zone of influence a little bit. You know, I can advocate for it, but I don't control the public transit. You know, same with, for instance, Ottawa is a problem that downtown, there's not enough density. There's not enough people living downtown. It's, it was only, offices before. So bringing in more residents, that's something we can all work on, but it's not the Nightlife Commissioner that's going to fix this problem.
It's interesting. The first few years I lived in Canada, I only went to Ottawa once. But one of my fondest memories of a night out was in Ottawa.
Oh, really?
And like stumbling out. What was it? It was probably like, it was like winter. So it was when the canal was frozen. We went to Ottawa, skated on the canal. One of our friends was ill and couldn't leave the Airbnb all weekend. But the rest of us went, we had like a really nice dinner that would have been like double the price in Toronto. And we were, like, there was a band playing in the Laugh in the market. And we were there until 2:30 in the morning drinking giant bottles of 50. We just had like there was nothing like super special about it. We just had a really fond memory of that night out.
Ottawa is that, can offer this, you know, like there's like the Laugh, it's been there for over 100 years, this small venue. And now it's been family owned for 3 generations.
Yeah.
So from grandfather, parents, and then it's the kids running it. So same with like another small venue called Irene's, and you know, it's been there for 40 years and it's family owned. And, you know, like when I moved here to Ottawa, I was like, wow, they still have $7. That is so great, because in Montreal, everything was $10 and above, and it's even worse in Toronto now. So,
yeah,
I think, you know, Ottawa can offer, if we work a little bit and we keep growing this sector, we can offer the same amenities that you will find in a bigger city, but at a more reasonable scale, human size scale, you know. And I think that can be a competitive advantage, competitive edge we can have over our two bigger siblings I was talking about when we started this discussion.
Well, also Ottawa has like possibly one of the best Irish bars in the world. Like the bar in the basement of the church.
Don't talk about this place. You're not supposed to talk about it. This is only for locals.
Okay, we'll bleep that out. We'll not.
You cannot talk about this, because they don't want tourists there. You know, upstairs is the church where Justin Trudeau got baptized.
Oh, I didn't know that. A friend of mine sent me pictures of the inside of the church, and then like in the back room, there's a space where like there was like an Irish folk band.
It's the Irish Association, I think, that has the
weren't confident enough to perform, but we were just sort of sat there like watching them like practice. It was great. It's like a lovely place. But I will remove the name of the bar, so we will talk about the name of the bar now.
Yeah, otherwise my friend Dan is gonna be angry at me. He's a regular there, so
we'll take that out. But like, I think like it has there's secondary cities that have those lovely, or smaller cities that have those lovely little pockets of like things that leave people with a good memory. They're great for the locals, so good that the locals don't want like the tourists to know about it. And I guess my question was going to be like, where do you look to for inspiration? Because like being a Brit, being born in Manchester, I assume Manchester's always like a good example for this. But like, where do you, apart from like what you've learned and tried and tested as an advocate in Montreal, where do you look to just go, that place does managing nightlife and nighttime culture really well?
You mean in terms of mid-sized cities or any city? Or?
I think probably more mid-sized cities.
Well, Bristol is crazy right now. The way they set it up, their nightlife office over there is, you know, and the particularity is that this nightlife office is part of public health over there, you know, because our positions are all like different. Like I'm embedded in ECDEV, in economic development. Yeah. Montreal, it's in culture. Toronto, it's in the visitors economy, so that means tourism. And yeah, Carly Heath in Bristol, she's from public health. She's she comes from the harm reduction movement, and they've been doing an amazing job in that aspect. I think you gotta find what's unique to your city, and you gotta build it. Like I really like Hamilton, because it's got this, it's alternative, it's experimental, you know, it's kind of like this black sheep vibe compared to Toronto the good, you know?
It's got a real chip. Like before the pandemic, there were loads of sous chefs who wanted their own restaurant, but they couldn't afford to open one in Toronto, so they were all like playing around in Hamilton with their own thing because they could afford it. It was very cool.
So, you know, I like the vibe there. I'm not sure that they're at the level they could be with in terms of nightlife governance, but they're certainly thinking about it, because I've had discussions with them. What has been really surprising me is the level of interest in Canada right now coming from mid-sized cities. It's not the big cities that are driving this nightlife governance movement. It's the mid-sized cities. You know, at Canada After Dark, we had Mississauga, Hamilton, London, Ontario, Kingston, and they're all like thinking, yeah, we want this, you know? And when you want something, you work for it. And that's a bit the case with what's happening in Ottawa here. When you have something and you start taking it for granted, well, that's a recipe for losing it. And that's what's happening with the bigger cities in Canada, like Vancouver, Toronto, or Montreal, I think. You know, there needs to be a bit of political courage to defend these businesses. And I, you know, it's been very trendy in the last decade to, you know, sometimes roll out programs of bike paths against citizens' opposition. But the politicians have had the courage to defend these projects because they believe it's for the best of the city. Well, they should have the same courage to defend our venues, you know, our nightlife venues and bars and restaurants, because, you know, they are the backbone of our After Dark economy and the vibrancy and the quality of life that they bring to residents and visitors. You know, not just, we're not doing this for tourism, you know, we're doing this because people, we tend to oppose nightlife owls and residents, but, you know, we're all residents here and we all sleep at some point, you know, so even I go to bed. So, you know, I think we got to stop talking this way. We got to switch our vocabulary around the lexicon around this and start figuring out that, you know, this is for the best of everyone. And sometimes, you know, we should not give too much leeway to individualism. And you know, because this is a trend in our societies today. And it's like people have this type of opinion that the society must change to fit their own individual needs and not the opposite, you know. And I think I tend to side more with the collective side of things, you know. It's like, well, you know, sometimes I go to bed and I'm going to hear noise and, you know, I'm going to be, you know, it's not my type of music and I want to go to bed, but it's one night, guys. And then the next morning, if it's not every night, I mean, that's not so much of an issue. I'm not going to make a complaint, you know. So
it's like an interesting thing, the bike lane. I think like Montreal is probably the best city in Canada for the bike lane. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of opposition at first, but like you now see streets where like there's traffic jams of bikes. Like where they can't all get through the traffic lights at the same time. And there's people of all shapes and sizes and ages and ethnicities riding bicycles, which is fantastic. And it's kind of like that same thing of like, not everyone's for it. And then people start to like, you end up like, it's like great local pubs. You'll have like a great local bar doesn't have like the same six bar flies. It has like, you look around and there's like a diversity to it. And some are in every day, some are in every week, some are in now and then. That's important.
But it's a good analogy because, you know, the more you build those bike paths, the more people start using it, the more people you convert to biking. Well, it's the same with nightlife. When we did the 24 to 29 hour party in Montreal the first time, everyone was like, you're crazy. This is not Berlin. This is Montreal. Why would you do this? It's not going to work. 2 years later, this year, just we're like June 9th now, and I saw five different 24-hour parties in Montreal popping up, you know. And people are like, yeah, it's so cool during the day. Families show up with their kids, and then at night, it's a bit rougher, you know. But there's like there's space for everyone. It brings such a cool vibe. It's a great time frame for artists to express themselves because they can play longer sets. I'm like, huh, you know, once you do it once, and people start figuring out and they fall in love with it and then they start imitating it. So, you know, as we say in French, l'appétit vient en mangeant.
This you talked about like the cities, the secondary cities in Canada. Hamilton's sort of a student city, but like London's a student city, Kingston's a student city, and students are so important to the life of those cities. But you can't.
Ottawa is a student city.
And Ottawa, you want them to stay. Like, there's this, like, actually, when I first did the Challenger Cities thing, it was about how do you keep young people in an economy rather than they all flood into London? Like, way before I started doing this as a podcast, that's what it was about. And I did it again in Edmonton, where it's like, how do you keep the talent from AI programs at the University of Alberta in Edmonton when 98% of the graduates who take a job leave and go elsewhere?
Yeah.
I think it's so important for those student cities of, like, if you're a student at Queens, how do you then, and you have like a business idea, rather than going and taking a corporate job in a Toronto or a Montreal, how do you then like create a business that stays in Kingston and maybe you build a life in Kingston? And it might have happened because of the nighttime economy. I think that that's like so important.
Absolutely. Now, if you spent 4 years studying in the city and then you were like, wow, it was so boring. The only thing I want to do is the minute I finish, when I get my diploma, I want to get away from here. It's not helping the city. You know, you got to be able to retain that those people who took a chance to move to your city because of their studies. You want to keep them as long as you can afterwards. So, and nightlife has a role to play there.
So you're a year in tomorrow. What do you hope comes of what you're doing in a year's time or 5 years' time?
Well, right now we're delivering the Nightlife Economy Action Plan. There were 10 recommendations, and we're on we got a little less than 18 months to roll them out, and we're on a good pace right now. What I'm looking forward to is creating a second action plan. Like what's coming next? Because this action plan ends with election in fall 2026. But I'm looking forward to build another strategy, maybe like a longer term strategy, a 5 or 10 year strategy, and hopefully get it adopted by municipal council at next term of council.
Cool. And then what help do you need? What's the sort of call to people in Ottawa to like help realize this?
I need projects. Honestly, you'd be surprised. I think people love to reach out to me with their ideas. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's too easy to have an idea. I want a project. Are you ready to deliver your idea? Well, then put it on paper. Come to me, and you might be surprised at the level of support you might get. But this was the same for me, when I started Montréal 24/24, I think I spent 50 complaining about the city not doing this and the city not doing that, when in the back rooms of parties and when everybody's half drunk at 1 a.m. Yeah. And then eventually we sat down, we created an organization, we created a plan, and then when we went to the city to complain, they were like, oh, okay, so you want to help with that? And then we were like, yeah. We were really surprised at the speed that we created this this relationship and this collaboration. And it's the same here. I think when people come to me with their projects and their projects make sense and they help deliver the recommendations and the goals and the mission of the action plan, well, we support them. So I would like to see more projects on my desk because people are like, okay, what are you going to do, commissioner? And I'm like, well, what are you going to do? I'm there to help you.
Yeah. And you brought up public transit a few times. I actually try sometimes to not bring public transit up because my friends take the piss out of me for always banging on about trains and trams and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's such a big part of nightlife. Like, how do you bring together like the public transport and the nightlife commissioner? Because I feel like sometimes transit people are a bit like, I don't want the drunk people on my train.
No, that hasn't been the case. The discussion have been, very interesting. They've been very supportive. I think the problem with the transit is just the funding of it.
Mm-hmm.
People who work in public transit, they want to see public transit everywhere all the time. This is their passion. So when you say you want transit, they're like, yeah, we want transit too. The problem is the funding. That's the biggest issue. And I think everyone understands that having public transit at night is not only a commodity, it's not only like useful for people, it's not only good for the economy, it's a safety issue.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at night, because if you want people to go out and enjoy their night out and have fun and have a couple of drinks, you don't want them to drive. If you want them to go out and then enjoy their night out, but they can't get home and they got to walk and they don't feel safe, well, that's an issue. They're not going to come. They're not going to go out, So that's the problem we have, I think, is around the funding structures of public transit here in Canada. And the problem is that it's so wide and there's not enough density. So that's why, people look up to Europe and they're like, wow, it's so amazing over there. It's not the same reality. So what can we do to address that? And I think that's a problem that for the upper levels of governments.
If you play the part of it, like the more people who are out, going out for dinner, going to a show, listen to music, whatever it might be, the more that happens, the more transit exists for them. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If there's transit systems that probably make more money at certain times of the night than they do at certain times during the middle of the day.
Yeah, but it's also the chicken or the egg dilemma, Yeah. It's like the restaurants are closing early, yes, because there's no one, but there's no one because the restaurants are closing early. And it's the same with public transit. So, I think we got to start somewhere. And the way to start is maybe like pilots and, you know, special events, and we're going to have new lounge. Let's open it up 24 hour, you know, like something like that. That's, and then you see what it's like. But at the end of the day, you know, even if it's not financially viable, you got to consider transit as a utility. You know, you need this for your community. So, but then it's up to the government to step up and find the funding for it.
Yeah. So I like to end these things on a slight less worrying about where the money's going to come from. Hmm. And more like, if I gave you a magic wand to apply to, it might be making Ottawa, it might be making Montreal, or just cities in general better for nightlife. What would you do with your magic wand?
Good question. I'm like in Fantasia now. I think we need to bring more awareness to this. And so, you know, I would love to be able with my magic wand to just take all the politicians out for a walk one night and make them walk the city at night. And then when it's like 1:30 in the morning and they want to pee and they can't find a bathroom and they have to pee in the park, you know, and they're like, and they know it's illegal to do this, but they have no choice to do it because there's no public bathroom. Well, they start understanding a little bit of, you know, what it is. And now we're going to go there. Oh, wow. I didn't know about this little bar. It's so cool. Yes. It's like a hole in the wall. Yeah. Well, this is, you know, it's discovery time. It's nighttime. This is what makes it so seductive, so sexy. At the same time, feels a little bit dangerous. You know, this is all the mystery of nightlife, and that's why people fall in love with the night and become night owls. So maybe I would do that. And I think on a bigger scale, what we need right now is all those cities in Canada and internationally to get together and create a real international network, like a global parliament of night mayors. I think that's something we should be working on for the near future.
I love that. One of the things I love doing with clients, like in my consulting work, is that you get put them in the persona of somebody who's not them and get them to go do their own product. And like airlines are always fun. Of like, go get that like head of marketing for an airline who always like buys tickets through the sort of the internal system.
Yeah.
Get them to go experience it as like a single mom or something like that. So I love the idea of like getting like politicians and basically sending them out clubbing. That'd be great.
You might never know who you never know who you might convert, you know.
There's always a few dark horses in there. Well, to that, I love the idea of like when you make Canada After Dark so big, it becomes like Cities After Dark, and you're like doing it in various different cities around the world. Like, I'm into that. So here's to making that real. That can be a project.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Yes.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you so much for like taking the time to have a chat with me. This is awesome stuff. Yeah. Go Ottawa.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian, and thanks for shedding some light on the darkness of the night.
Thank you once again for listening all the way to the end of a Challenger Cities podcast. Really do appreciate it. As always, if you can give it a like, share, leave us a comment, that's always really, really helpful for growing this thing. If there's likewise people that you think would be fantastic for us to interview, please do send them along. Always interested in new ideas and new voices that we should be getting out there. I produce these podcasts mostly as a bit of a labor of love, but also because I really want to make an impact on making cities better places to live, play, and work. I do a lot of that through my consulting business called Now and Ever. Basically, we're really, really good at going out and looking at what I call next practices rather than best practices. So the things that are relevant for companies to be doing next rather than homogenizing themselves with what people are already doing now. Do a lot of customer ethnography, so spending time with real people to understand actually what they think and how they behave and all their weird and wonderful quirks. And then a lot of prototyping. So what does it all mean? What's the implication of these things that we learn? What might we do about it? And how can we go and experiment with it? So very keen to do more of that with cities, more of that with policy, more of that with companies that should really genuinely just give more of a care about the urban physical realm. So that's my plug. Thanks again, and we'll see you on a new episode very, very soon.